You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, June 16th, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, staff writer at the New Republic, author of Overheated, How Capitalism Broke the Planet, and How We Fight Back, Kate Aronoff will be here. Meanwhile, Joe Biden, Vladimir Putin, meet in Geneva. Didn't resolve much. Meanwhile, Israel launches new airstrikes on Gaza in retaliation of Hamas's sending incendiary balloons into the sky. This is a BFD. Joe Biden names Lina Khan chair of the Federal Trade Commission. Not only is there an anti-monopoly majority on the FTC, but an anti-monopolist is the chair. They have a lot of authority and don't need new legislation to use it. Progressive dissent over the Gang of 10 infrastructure deal starting to boil over as Schumer says reconciliation process has started. Meanwhile, the Senate approves a bill to make Juneteenth a federal holiday. New data shows that long-haul COVID can afflict even the asymptomatic. And in Worcester, Massachusetts, St. Vincent nurses on day 100 of a strike, one of the longest in Massachusetts in decades. Meanwhile, medical debt charity buys $278 million of patient debt. Lastly, Connecticut starts offering baby bonds to parents living in low income. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us. You know, there are just days where I have trouble, you know, remembering what year it is or articulating it. So 2021, you get into a rhythm and you say 20, and then it just seems weird.
It is June, but yeah, I think, you know, we can let it slide.
I mean, I expect that to last until 2022.
I'm hard on you because I expect excellence.
I appreciate that. Emma Viglin here to be basically grading me in a moment-to-moment basis. I appreciate that.
I'm trying to, like, recall memories of that baseball coach that you dealt with when you were growing up.
Yes, he was pretty harsh. Much worse on his own son, frankly, than he was on me or other players. But
that's how I see you.
Yeah, there you go. Well, thank you. That's great.
Welcome to the show.
Yes, welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. Glad you could make it today. Some things going on. I mean, right now in Washington, D.C., there's sort of like this stasis as we await, I think, when Biden gets back into town. And there is supposedly he's given another week or so for this Gang of 10 to come up with a deal. Meanwhile, as I said, Chuck Schumer has made it clear that the reconciliation process has started. Now, this involves a lot of committee work. There are specific resolutions that need to be brought up because reconciliation is a sort of a unique type of legislation, legislative process, I should say. And it can only deal with measures that directly impact the federal budget. Now, of course, this is all rules that are made up by the Senate and can be changed by the Senate if they really wanted to. The way that the senators view the Senate itself is that these rules are sacrosanct, in part because it also allows them certain guardrails that they can blame as opposed to their own refusal to do things. So it's not me, it's the Senate that's constraining me. And you know, that is, you know, it's not us, it's the filibuster. This is the way that they play that game. But that the fact that reconciliation is starting, you can look at it in two ways. One, that this is encouraging because the Democrats will be ready to go. Or two, that it's really just a way of creating more pressure on this gang of 10 to come up with a really insufficient compromise. Now, with that said, even if the gang of 10 comes up with a deal, it's five Republicans and five Democrats. You still need five more Republicans to sign on to anything that they do, and that's highly unlikely. So the idea that they're going forward with the reconciliation at least says that we're not going to get completely sidetracked by what this so-called gang of 10 is doing. They are anticipating going forward with reconciliation by July. So that's the good news.
Well, I do want to caution, though, that this bipartisan bill, McConnell's held off on saying if he'll back it. You know, it's only, what, $1 trillion of over nearly $600 billion of it is in new spending, et cetera, which could be a way for McConnell to sap Manchin and Sinema, take those votes away from the reconciliation process, because then they could say, oh, we found this bipartisan agreement, we're in favor of it, and then they wouldn't have the 50 votes that they need in reconciliation. So that's just one thing I want the audience to look out for. McConnell, as of reports from yesterday, is apparently weighing, how am I going to deal with this gang of 10 reconciliation deal? Because if he throws his weight behind it, then you actually could get...
If McConnell allows for a bill to pass in the Senate, the big fear, like you say, is that one thing that was floated was the idea that, like, okay, we'll do a smaller bill with the Republicans that they can agree with, and then we'll take all the other stuff that that we want, that Republicans won't do, and we'll pass that in reconciliation. But like you say, once Manchin or in Sinema or whomever vote for the first bill, if McConnell gives that a green light, then they are less inclined to vote for the second bill. And that's, but if I had to bet, I would say McConnell is just, he knows how to play the completely obstruct game. And it has served him quite well.
This would just be the sabotage game, which I don't know. I mean,
they would still pass, I don't know, $500-600 billion of new funding. And right. I have a feeling Republicans just don't want to do that.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But we shall see. And we'll have a better sense of that in the next 2 weeks, because to get that reconciliation done before they go on break, they need to get this whole process basically done by the third week or so. They need to have that vote the third week or so of July. And we will know sooner rather than later. Meanwhile, this is good to see. About 2 or 3 years ago, I guess 2019, maybe January, the Democrats, maybe February, the Democrats unveiled their Big for the People Act, which was known as H.R. 1 in the House. Ultimately became S1 in the House and the Senate, I should say. This is the one that Joe Manchin has basically said he won't vote for.
Ends partisan gerrymandering, creates a process that would crack down on corruption with a matching system, among other things.
And voting rights. And this was going to be a big rollout. It's an impressive piece of legislation. And the Democrats stepped all over it, because they were falling all over themselves to criticize Ilhan Omar at the time, because she had said something to the effect of, you know, the Israeli lobby is outsized in Washington, D.C., which was a rather uncontroversial statement when Tom Friedman said it, for instance. Yet she was attacked, and it's as if we have a reprise. The other day that she was talking about the International Criminal Court. She used the word United States, Hamas, Israel, and Taliban all in the same sentence. And apparently you're not allowed to do that. And the Democrats, or I should say a small group of Democrats, plus the Democratic leadership, chastised her for this. And this is good to see. John Yarmuth, congressman from Kentucky, the third district, I should say, came out. There was a couple of other Democrats who came out and said, you know, enough is enough. This is ridiculous.
A squad, but more than that, too.
But more than that. And here's Yarmuth, not a Democratic socialist from the Bronx, but rather a congressman from Kentucky. And here is he comes out and defends Ilhan Omar. Check this out.
Well, I think a lot of my colleagues overreacted to her remarks. I think there's, you know, it's always fair for a member to criticize the policies of a government and or of a governmental leader. I've been highly critical of the Israeli government's policies and now former Prime Minister Netanyahu. I don't think anybody would call me anti-Semitic. And I think that's, again, I think they just overreacted, which without actually considering exactly what she said. And, you can, the fact that you'd put Hamas and in the same sentence with the United States does not necessarily mean that you're equating the two. And I think that was an unfair assumption that some of my colleagues made.
There was a resolution that came out today authored by Congressman Waltz and Rashida Tlaib's name, AOC is named, Ayanna Pressley is named, Ilhan Omar is named. You are not named. Betty McCollum is not named. Mark Pocan is not named. All of you have been critical of Israel. All of you have called Israel an apartheid state. Mm-hmm. Why aren't you named in the resolution?
Well, I'm neither black nor female nor Muslim. I don't think it's fair. I don't think it's right. Congresswoman Omar has as much right to criticize Israel or any other government or any other national leader as any other member of Congress without being singled out.
Awesome.
And we should say Yarmuth is Jewish, and so he
Are you sure he doesn't have internalized anti-Semitism?
It's I will leave that to others to decide. But good for him.
This is writing something up right now.
Good for him for coming out. That's important, and it is, I think, an indication of a growing sort of sense, at least in the institutionalization on some level of the more progressive members of the House, where they're getting, some measure of at least just sort of decent protection. There's not a knee-jerk attack on them or fear of defending them. And
just good job and a recognition that his Democratic colleagues who aid and abet this are complicit in the death threats and vitriol leveled at Ilhan Omar and AOC and whoever else speaks out against this. I mean, he makes the point that it is a racialized, misogynistic undertone, at least, you know, from the right wing for sure. And Democratic leadership is at the very least blind to it. But I think they're aware of it and they're trying to use her as a punching bag in order to shore up a specific kind of base. And
I think that's true, too. And I think they're also and a distraction. And it's a mistake and good for Yarmuth. That is it's nice to see. All right. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Kate Aronoff. She is a staff writer at The New Republic and author of Overheated: How Capitalism Broke the Planet and How We Fight Back. We'll be right back after this. Folks. Today's show is in part sponsored by Harry's, Harry's Razor. Now I'm a day further out from shaving this week. I pushed it all the way to Wednesday. I probably might shave I don't know. I may go the whole week.
So, like, the less you shave, though, right? The less you need to shave. That's the
no,
thing.
It doesn't work.
Oh,
it doesn't work that way. But I will tell you this: when I do shave, I choose Harry's. And why? Because with Harry's, you don't have to choose between a great shave and an incredibly and a fair price. And as you know, we are just a couple of days away from Father's Day. And the trick I always used to do was you order something online. I don't know if it will come. It might come in time. But if it doesn't, you just download a picture of it and you hand it to them.
Put in a card.
I've done that many, many times.
Yes.
And then you actually give them two presents. You give them the representation of the present, and then you get to give them the present, and you get credit for it twice. You make your people, your dad or whoever, you know, a guy in your life. It doesn't even have to be a guy, but I mean, this is what they're angling at right now. A Harry's razor, and they're going to be happy twice that way. You can redeem a trial set for just $3 or get $5 off any shave set when you go to harrys.com/majority. Harry's gift sets make a great gift for any guy in your life year round. And their new graphite Winston razor handle is even engravable. So you can personalize your gift. Like I say, Harry's delivers a close, comfortable shave at a super fair price. It is still as low as $2 per refill on the blades. And if you have gone to your local, I don't know, whatever it is, supermarket or, you know, one of those super pharmacy places, you'll know. It's like you got to bring... got to break the bank just to buy a set of blades for the week. Harry's went out. They bought a factory in Germany. It's been making precision engineered blades for over 100 years. And then Harry's design team combined a weighted ergonomic handle with their signature blade cartridge. It's smart, very simple razor designed for delivering a close shave all along the contours of your face with blades designed to stay sharp. They stand behind the quality of their blades so much they have a 100% money-back guarantee on harrys.com. I have a very classic handle, sort of like chrome-looking, and it's very simple. It's weighted, feels good when you shave. I never really appreciated any of that. Just like what it, like design. I'm like, as I get older, I am a little bit more. But it's nice. It's a great shave, and like I say, it is not going to break the bank. So check it out. This is a good opportunity for you. Harry's is giving their best offer to Majority Report listeners. New Harry's customers get a starter set for just $3. Plus, Harry's is doing a limited time offer for all customers starting now through Father's Day. You can take $5 off any shave set at harrys.com/majority. There's truly never been a better time to try Harry's. Go to harrys.com/majority to start your own Harry's journey or save a few bucks on a special gift for a special dad in your life. I don't know, a special dad, like all your dads. I mean, maybe you have multiple. I mean, it's possible you could have multiple dads.
Your husband dad.
Folks have two dads too, so maybe like.
Oh.
But I would give them to both.
Sorry for being
I wouldn't
never
pick
wrong.
One and decide one is more special than the other. That would hurt.
Yeah. Usually, if you have two dads, you want to consider them both special. I would want to.
I think so.
Right.
But look, people can. I'm not going to get involved in people's family relationships. God knows that. All right, let's do this. Hello, Tushy is once again essentially pushing me
to
the
edge.
Are
you going to read the real ad read?
I'm going to.
Good.
Summer's here. This is the way they want me to start. And the living ain't easy if you've got swamp ass. I don't know what that means, but how are you going to stay on top of your sweaty bottom? Well, it's easy. A refreshing spray from a Hello Tushy bidet. I don't know if they meant to make that rhyme. I'm not going to read that part. Look, a bidet really is, honestly, a revelation. I don't want to get too into it, but probably the best thing that came out of COVID for me. I don't know if I would have tried a bidet, but it was, you know, like in the wake of like the toilet paper, the great toilet paper shortages of 2020. And Kyle was like, I got a bidet and it's amazing. And I'm like, I'll try this one out from Hello Tushy. I got the 2.0. I've upgraded to the 3.0 now. It is stylish. It is eco-friendly. It is super easy to install and it saves you money. Hello Tushy 3.0 doesn't just clean your butt with a precise stream of fresh water. It cleans itself, too, with a smart spray automatic nozzle. It attaches to your existing toilet. Literally, all you got to do is you got to lift up the toilet seat, you unscrew it. It's super easy. You could do that with your fingers, and then you just need a wrench. You put it into the existing plumbing. You don't need any new plumbing. You don't need any electricity. And it will pay for itself in a few months. Plus, it cuts toilet paper use by 80%. Hello Tushy has your ass covered, as they say, with a 60-day risk-free guarantee and a 12-month warranty. If you've already got a Hello Tushy, upgrade to the 3.0. And if you're new to the revolution, know that you're joining millions of happy Hello Tushy customers. Defeat swamp ass. Go to HelloTushy.com/majority. Get 10% off plus free shipping. This is a special offer for our listeners at HelloTushy.com/majority for 10% off. HelloTushy.com/majority. I will tell you right now, folks, it is, check it out, because it is less expensive than you think it is. And if you've ever been bidet curious, I guess it's like bi curious, bidet curious, right? No. Try it out. All right. Want to welcome back to the program, staff writer at the New Republic, author of Overheated, How Capitalism Broke the Planet and How We Fight Back, Kate Aronoff. Kate, it's a pleasure to have you back again. I'm here with Emma Viglin.
Thanks so much for having me.
Your book is basically two parts, as you know. One is sort of how we got here, and then the other part is, you know, sort of where we should go in many respects. But let's talk about how, you know, the world that has been constructed for us in some respects that makes it very, very difficult to deal with climate change, particularly on like a personal level, as it were.
Yeah, well, to back up just slightly, I mean, part of the reason I was interested in writing the book was, you know, to look at this weird thing that seems so unique to the United States called climate denial. And what I found sort of looking back at that, so it's really hard to understand climate denial as sort of removed from this broader shift to the right, you know, both within the Republican Party, and something that I look at and is very close to the heart of the sort of story of how this country got screwed up around the question of climate change is right-wing think tanks, right? So you have bodies like the American Enterprise Institute, Heritage Foundation, you know, people like James Buchanan, the Koch brothers famously, right? All of these institutions are really core to dragging the country to the right through the 20th century. And so I, you know, look in the book about the very fruitful overlap, right, between the fossil fuel industry and fossil fuel money and this really broader shift, right, to inject some really radical ideas about how the economy works, about how the government works, and what that does alongside these sort of broader trends like red baiting, right, alongside white supremacy, which is always sort of core to the right wing project in the U.S. That, you know, this really helps to take a lot of what should be common sense ideas for how to deal with the climate crisis off the table by the time it enters the public consciousness in the late 80s, right? So that by that point, by the time, you know, by that it's global warming, it's not called climate change quite yet, but by the time people are really talking about heating, right? By the time people are talking about planetary heating, that the most reasonable ways of dealing with it are sort of out of public consciousness, and everything gets filtered through this logic of markets and this logic that, you know, it is the private sector which is best equipped to do anything, and the government really can't, you know, play a big role in this, and that would be a sort of bad thing in and of itself if we were to have harsher regulations or public ownership or any of the things that have been pretty common, you know, to even U.S. history, let alone sort of policy solutions elsewhere.
I mean, is that why? I mean, because as far as I know, the Republican Party is unique in the world of being a major political party that has, you know, for all intents and purposes, maybe it's changing now. They've shifted from you know, climate change existing to, like, you know, whether it's man-made to whether it's really there's something we can deal with. But there's no other major political party in the world that has held that position. And it's not like we're, you know, is it that we're unique, that this country has a unique conservatism? Or is it, I mean, was it just like business interests here were so savvy or adept that they were going to construct this whole thing? Because it seems to me there was, like, much of what you write about was constructed, at least to a large part, in the early 70s. And, you know, you had the Lewis Powell memo that was commissioned by the Chamber of Commerce that was, in many respects, a response to not just sort of the emancipatory things that were happening in this country at the time, but really, you know, what was happening from an environmental standpoint. People became aware of this. We also at that point hit peak oil production in this country. People knew that was, you know, at least the oil companies knew the amount of oil that we were going to be able to produce, at least at that dollar point, was going to drop. I mean, is that what was going on here? Is just, like, you know, business constructed this whole sort of, on some level, like this massive movement? I mean, there were pieces there, right? I mean, we had a decent amount of racism, but these things were sort of congealed in some way to provide, like, a, I don't know, forgive the metaphor, an iron dome around this profit motive.
Yeah, I mean, so you do see shades of climate denial in places like Australia, the UK, Germany. Alternative for Deutschland sort of dabbles in climate denial a bit. But so far as I can tell, wherever it shows up, it really is sort of an export from the United States, and often are getting, you know, direct support from places like the Heartland Institute. And, you know, the place sort of I came to on this question is that there's so much machinery built up through what's really, you know, organizing on behalf of business conservatives through the 1940s and 50s, you know, for decades, right? I mean, Kim Phillips Fine's great book, Invisible Hands, really tells this story very well. But, you know, it is very advanced in the United States. We have a very advanced infrastructure to sort out these problems. And so when the climate crisis comes along, you know, people aren't stupid, right? I don't think that the folks who are running these think tanks and sort of spouting climate denial when that was more prominent in the debate necessarily believe it, right? Maybe a couple of them do. But what they recognize very early on is that dealing with the climate crisis, right? Naomi Klein makes this point as well. Dealing with the climate crisis requires such massive changes to a business as usual, which is very profitable for them, that even entertaining the conversation of doing something about it is so damaging to their business model. And, you know, the U.S. is a major fossil fuel producer, right? We produce a lot of fossil fuels, and we don't, you know, tend to think of ourselves as a petrostate. But in many ways, right, that is very core to the U.S. identity. And so that is a very powerful influence on how climate change gets talked about, to say, you know, whether or not, you know, we know that companies like Exxon and Shell, that they knew very early on sort of both that the climate crisis was happening, how damaging it would be, and what a profound effect their core business model had on it, right? They knew this early on. And so the tactic is to say, well, it's not happening, right? This, you know, fund people who will say this isn't a problem, which allows you to push that conversation 10, 20, 30, 40 years down the line, which is what's happened. And what's why, you know, we're only now sort of starting to have a productive conversation about this. And that's different, you know, from places like Europe, where even the European oil majors, Shell, BP, these other companies have had a very different line. I think probably most people in the United States would rather be there. I'm wary to say it's better. I think it's very different. And I don't think, you know, we're necessarily doomed to be behind Europe forever. And there's plenty of flaws with things like the European Green Deal and how the policy conversation has been sorted out there. But in the United States, this thing happens where we, you know, it revolved this entire debate around is climate change happening or not, and not, you know, what do we do about it, which is a much meatier, thornier question to deal with. And we're only now having it, which is a disaster, right? It's 2021. These conversations should have been happening 30, 40 years ago when we first learned about this problem. And instead, we're just catching up and sort of starting to sort through the very complicated questions of, do we need a carbon tax? Do we need, you know, much broader scale industrial policy, these sorts of things, which we're just really, really behind.
Well, I just wanted to ask if you could expand on that relationship that the United States has with oil, right? One, its relationship with capitalism seems intrinsically embedded in the even just like cultural way that we see oil. I mean, there's like just in New Orleans or Louisiana, I should say, or in Texas. I mean, it's very much embedded in a lot of the way many Americans see the country, which I feel like is unique in its own specific way. Just curious if you could expand on that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of these politics really crystallize around the oil crisis in 1973, which, you know, there's a lot that goes into that. And I spend a little bit of time on it in the book. But what that really does is sort of question whether the U.S. needs to depend on other countries for its energy, which it always has. And what is sort of feeding into that moment is decolonization, right? There are countries who have a lot of oil reserves who have historically been in these either colonial or quasi-colonial relationships with major oil producers, including companies like BP or Standard Oil, which sort of is splintered off into companies like Chevron and Exxon at some point, but have always, you know, had this very sort of bound up relationship with Middle East oil producers. And so at a time when, you know, different countries are sort of fighting independence battles, are you know, claiming control, right, of these natural resources to build wealth in their own countries instead of funneling that abroad, the U.S. loses its mind, right? And that's, you know, how we have to understand the crisis in 1973 is not necessarily as a shortage of oil, which it really wasn't, right? Supplies of oil to the U.S. weren't really threatened, but it was this moment of, you know, countries really asserting sovereignty over their natural resources. And the you know, oil sector, the private oil sector, you know, particularly in the United States, has always depended for its lifeblood on, in some sense, minority rule, right? And that, you know, aligns very well with the right-wing project in the U.S., and they need to suppress the right of other countries to take wealth. And that happens in smaller ways, you know, in the fossil fuel economy here, right? There's a reason why places like Appalachia, you know, even places like West Texas, who just funneled all that wealth right toward the top in, you know, what in most normal, you know, oil, gas, coal producing nations is considered the sort of wealth of the nation, that just is, you know, hoarded by a handful of executives who have totally warped our politics, who have really starved whole parts of this country, which, you know, have been crucial to building the wealth of this country. And, you know, that's very unique. That's very unique to the United States. And I think helps explain sort of why, you know, we are have such a strange identity as like an oil producer and a major oil consumer.
How has that been so obscured? I mean, not, you know, obviously, you know, but how has it not seeped into the consciousness of, I mean, I always, you know, like I look at Appalachia and, you know, I talk to people who are, you know, in West Virginia or whatnot. And they're, you know, most of the people I talk to are like, yeah, they literally like scrape up the surface of the earth and we're being completely exploited. But how is it that, but on some level, it also feels like it's being obscured and has not gotten into the consciousness of people that they can find that they're, you know, I don't know. I mean, we have moments in this country where people realize like, hey, wait, we're being taken advantage of here. But it seems for like large swaths of particularly when it comes to fossil fuel, that consciousness doesn't seem to emerge. Why is that?
Yeah, there's a lot of reasons. I mean, I think one, right, is just this broad sort of shift in throughout the 20th century toward seeing private sector actors and companies as sort of heroes, and making them out to be, you know, the sort of titans of industry who are creating jobs and doing great things for the nation. And there's plenty of propaganda to feed that. But, you know, this isn't unique to the fossil fuel industry, of course, but there is this logic of divide and conquer, which is really shot through, right? It, you know, if you talk to miners in West Virginia 40 or 50 years ago, they would not have told you the coal boss was their friend, probably, right? These were heavily unionized industries, fought really militant battles against coal companies for better wages, for work. It's not like they were talking about climate change, but there was militant union organizing throughout the mines from the United Mine Workers, right? And that is systematically killed. And part of the way that that organizing in the fossil fuel sector is killed off is to pit different groups of workers against each other. You know, I think about Robin D.G. Kelly's work on Alabama, the coal mines in Alabama, and how, you know, they would bring in black strikebreakers to really pit white workers against black workers and really break up any sort of hint of multiracial solidarity in the mines. And you see that sort of across the board. You know, even if you look at sort of the workforce of a lot of refineries that can be predominantly white in predominantly black areas, right? So there's this divide and conquer politics, which happens in the United States and also happens at the micro level by saying, we don't want their oil. We don't want oil from the Middle East. We want homegrown American oil. And, you know, most, that's not sort of a conscious choice if you're filling up a gas tank. But if you're watching the news, then it's an easy thing, especially, you know, in seeped in the politics of things like the war on terror, to sort of point a finger abroad and you know, make it seem as if it's so vitally important to the U.S. that we continue drilling as much oil as possible here.
Do you want to talk about some of the both the market solutions that have come up over the years, and also not just sort of the failure of them to be implemented and maybe the failure of their structure, but their function as a way of sort of limiting the conversation as to what we need to do to address these things?
Sure. Yeah. So I look mostly in the book at sort of a suite of policies known as carbon pricing. So that includes cap and trade, which people might be familiar with from policy battles about a decade ago, a bill called Waxman-Markey that looked to implement a cap and trade program in the United States, as well as a carbon tax, which exists in some states today, in some countries abroad. And try to trace back why, you know, these policies become so popular. So on the one hand, it's a little bit of a fluke of modeling, right? And it's very easy within a climate economy model, this, you know, sort of technology developed in around the 70s, to look at the impact of climate policy on economic growth. And the sort of main input that modelers have is carbon pricing, is to change the price of carbon. And, you know, what that means is changing the price of oil, changing the price of gas and coal, right? And so that gets looked at as the most efficient, you know, economists still say this today, the most efficient policy for dealing with climate change. And what has become clear, at least in the United States, right? And the book really does focus on the United States, is that it's not very efficient because they're very hard to get passed, right? And they're very hard to actually implement, which all climate policy is, but there's a particular sort of playbook which is built up around carbon pricing, which makes the right very good at attacking it. You know, I look at the 2009-2010 cap and trade fight, and, you know, what we see there is this very reliable tactic from the fossil fuel industry, from companies like Exxon, to say, we agree there's a problem, right? We agree that climate change is real, that it's bad. They're not denying climate change at that point, even if maybe they were still funding people who were, you know, saying similar things. But their public line, right, is that we would rather have an economy-wide carbon tax because that's much more efficient. And this cap and trade thing, this is not, you know, what we want. And so what you see is different forms of carbon pricing pitted against each other as a means to battle off whatever climate policies actually on the table. And we're seeing this right now, right? We're talking about giving or putting a decent chunk of spending for green investment into an infrastructure plan, right? Those debates are very complicated right now. But what ExxonMobil, what fossil companies are saying and did, you know, really at the start of the Biden administration, the American Petroleum Institute came out with a policy in support of carbon pricing for the first time ever. So again and again, you know, regardless of the merits of the actual policy, which, you know, I think are very debatable, politically, it's wielded as this cudgel against any actually existing climate policy.
And so, I mean, how does that happen? It's like it just muddies the water and basically says, like, we're going to make every step that we take somewhat controversial, and really we're going to pretend like we're arguing efficacy when what we're really doing is just slow in the roll as it is.
Yeah. I mean, and there's like, that's like the public line, right? Is that we want a carbon tax. We want this more efficient thing, whatever. Behind the scenes, right, they're just funneling money to the GOP, which has a party line that says we don't want to pass anything called climate policy. So that's, you know, really a win-win. They can water down or confuse the debate about whatever policy is actually on the table. And behind the scenes, they're just trying to make sure nothing passes at all by funding, you know, trade associations and politicians who are working toward that end.
And to be clear, the carbon tax, the way that it's supposedly set to work is that it just prices, it makes oil increasingly and petroleum products increasingly more expensive so that substitutes end up, you know, slowly overtaking the function of oil and gas in our society. And I mean, so on some level, it basically offloads the pain of transition to everybody but the producer.
Yeah, and we've seen what happens when countries try to do this, right? The Gilets Jaunes movement in France, right, was a result of passing a carbon tax. And, you know, I don't think a carbon tax in itself is a bad idea. I think it's good at certain things like raising revenue. I think it can sort of drive certain tweaks in behavioral, you know, in behavior that might be helpful to the planet, but to consider it in a vacuum, which is sort of what economic modeling encourages us to do, is to think about the world as if it exists in a model, is absurd, right? Somebody is not going to want to pay more for gas when there is a train line which hasn't been invested in right, you know, 20 or 30 years, or there isn't a train line, right? And they need to drive 30 miles to get to their first and second job. And if it's not nestled within a much, much broader array of policy, which is making those sorts of shifts actually possible for people and actually reasonable, then of course it's going to produce a massive backlash.
And we should say, yeah, that's yellow vests for those of us who do not speak French.
I also don't speak French. I
do not. But and so just to be clear, the carbon tax is an effective policy as a rear guard measure, essentially, right? It comes in and cleans up and is an incentivizing you to go to the greener pasture that we've already built. But the way that we're implementing it is we're just pushing you out the door and there's nothing out there, essentially, and that we have constructed. All right. So let's move into sort of your suite of non-reform reforms, I guess, as you refer to them. If you were going to construct something, I mean, obviously it would look like the Green New Deal that, you know, on some measure that we have seen. I mean, let's just start with the idea of how do we get that passed? Like, how do we implement these non-reform reforms, like major structural changes to our economy, when we've got a guy who literally shot the cap and trade bill with a shotgun? I've said in the past an AR-15, I guess it was a shotgun. It's been a long time since I saw that ad. And that's how Joe Manchin got to office. That was his big commercial, like, and literally firing at the stack of pages that were supposedly the cap and trade. How do we get there, like, politically?
Yeah, So what I argued in the book and me and several co-authors sort of wrote about in co-authored book A Planet to Win is that there has to be this virtuous cycle between policy and politics, right? So sort of reigning logic of the Democratic Party for a long time was that if you give people stuff that makes their lives better, they're probably more likely to vote for you. That fell out of fashion for some of the reasons we talked about earlier in the 1970s and 1980s, but that is, you know, a fairly standard logic. That's not a magic bullet, but climate policy probably has to follow something like that. So for many, many years, climate policy has been talked about, you know, like the carbon tax, like, you know, these other sort of market-driven tweaks as something which can be fit in sort of around the edges. It's the sort of realm of technocrats and, you know, something that only, you know, can be dealt with basically in a boardroom or by, you know, very skilled people who are taking a serious look at this problem. And we just know that the problem is way too big to fit around the edges, right? Somebody's going to know when we have a fossil fuel industry with a PR arm, which is very ready to call out anything called climate policy. So what I argue is that, you know, you have to bring that to the people. And this is what folks who are pushing for a Green New Deal really center on, is that climate policy has to make a credible threat to make people's lives better, right? And so I look at policies like a federal job guarantee, right, which can do a lot of this very climate necessary work that the private sector isn't prioritizing, and also would have a massive impact on people's lives, right? Taking away involuntary unemployment, giving people a job that is dignified, that pays them a living wage, that is improving their own communities with work that is decided, you know, by folks from their communities, right? These sorts of things, I think, have to start the cycle to, you know, to put it very bluntly, reelect Democrats for a long time to come, right? It's not enough to just have a sort of one-off climate policy passed and, you know, to cede over to Republican rule, which will strike it down in the courts, maybe even before an election happens, which will, you know, pass new laws or repeal them or whatever. What we saw in the New Deal and have seen, you know, throughout U.S. history is that it takes sort of sustained role by, you know, in our case now, the Democratic Party. And unfortunately, I don't, you know, no real warm feelings, right, toward the party apparatus. But practically, when we have one of two major parties that is, right, you know, not interested in climate policy, also just not terribly interested in liberal democracy, that is what it takes. And so climate policy really has to bring its real offer to the people, to voters, which is, you know, thankfully very real, right? Providing millions of jobs in wind and solar, creating something like a federal job guarantee, you know, putting people to work, doing all of this sort of crucial work for low carbon transition. All of these things can be very attractive, right, to voters. But that is, you know, just not sort of the climate conversation that's been had so far. It's been the sort of rule of experts type thing. And if we just believe the science or whatever, that'll build the world we need. And we know that's not true. And we know, you know, we need to create policies that people like and are going to vote for, and, you know, are going to reelect people based on them and elect people based on them.
What's the progress of that? I mean, I'm just sort of tracking, like, you know, the, you know, Gore's Inconvenient Truth, right? Which is saying, like, you know, presenting, like, presenting the vision of dealing with climate change we've got to create a bunch of disincentives, as opposed to what the Green New Deal is, we've got to create a bunch of incentives.
Right.
Like, it's that basically that notion, like, you know, we're going to give you a reason to walk through that door, as opposed to we're going to, you know, sort of like curb how much you can stay inside type of thing. Mm-hmm. And where are we in that? If we have been able to move from the Inconvenient Truth to a Green New Deal, where we see this as an opportunity to provide material benefit to people, which, you know, coincides with also dealing with these problems that we have, where are we in the sort of like the uptake of that?
Yeah, I think there has been a real shift. I mean, as tough as the path toward passing a Green New Deal looks in the United States and like the muck of this like horrible infrastructure debate, it reemerging out of the scene in 2018 with the sit-in at Nancy Pelosi's office by the Sunrise Movement that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez joins, right? This really does shift something for politicians, you know, both in the US where even candidates like Joe Biden, or I should say presidents like Joe Biden, right, who takes it up sort of after he's elected and, you know, has these meetings with Sunrise and integrates it into at least his rhetoric for what climate policy should look like to frame it as a matter of investment. We're going to create jobs, right? Takes the sort of big top line talking points about the Green New Deal and integrates them into a plan, which, you know, I think is not great in its own right. And you see, you know, countries abroad in South Korea, the government won re-election running on a Green New Deal. Spain, the same thing. The European Green Deal, which is a whole sort of mixed bag of weird public-private partnerships, but that takes up this basic logic, which really, you know, does some of the work that sort of centrist politicians had not been able to do, which is to say this is not a matter of collective sacrifice. It's not that dealing with the climate crisis means making your life worse. There's a tremendous opportunity for jobs, for investment, for all these things that can fall out of actually dealing with this crisis, and really, you know, helps to shift the conversation in a real way to make this, again, about jobs, about investment, about, you know, building up more of the things that we want.
Is there a sequencing, like, I mean, when you look at this, is there a linchpin, I guess, where, I mean, I guess, you know, just as an analogy, you know, I see vigorous antitrust, like returning to our pre-1980 antitrust disposition as a good step one in weakening the financial and thus the political power of those who are standing in the way of greater reforms, right? Like, is there one in the context of what you've laid out that you perceive is, from a sequencing standpoint, the sort of the lowest hanging fruit and the first step on the ladder that will make the subsequent steps more possible?
Yeah, I mean, I think just thinking about like what a mess the legislative process is, it probably makes sense to focus on what can happen within the administration. And there's actually a lot of tools, right? I know like David Dayan has done a lot of this work, fleshing that out. Jeff Hauser, the Revolving Door Project, you know, have laid out the sort of whole mass of things, including, you know, speaking of stuff in the realm of antitrust, the Dodd-Frank rules, which, you know, provide a path for policymakers without putting it to a vote to restrict investments in fossil fuels from major banks, right? The Fed could declare climate change an existential threat to systemic threat to the economy, and really restrict the sort of cut off the flow of financing to fossil fuels. So I think logistically, right, that's probably the way to go. Sure. Short of whatever can happen in this infrastructure bill, which looks pretty limited, there's a lot of just sort of regulatory power that the administration has, whether it wants to use it, who knows, but could, you know, do things like reinstate the crude oil export ban, which, you know, was in place from the 1970s through 2015, and has turned the U.S. into a major fossil fuel exporter, and that it just wasn't before. So there's a lot that can be done, you know, in the short term. I think it's a tricky question of how to sequence that, because of some of the politics we talked about before, right? That stuff is not necessarily sexy, will be sort of framed as restrictions. It's not going to give people, you know, the things that they might want out of climate policy, like a job, right? That's hard to do through some of these regulatory mechanisms. But there's a lot that can be done really, really short term that can have a huge impact on you know, the carbon emissions in the United States.
Why does the explain to folks why it is problematic for us to regain our status as an exporter of fuel? Like, why? What are the implications of that?
Yeah, so it's totally possible, right, for the United States to decarbonize domestically, to, you know, get rid of internal combustion engines, to green our power sector, to bring a lot more activity onto the grid. We could be a green economy, right? And that is totally compatible. There's a way for that to be totally compatible with sending massive amounts of coal, oil, and gas to be exported abroad, which is, you know, has been a sort of, seems to be kind of what the Biden administration is thinking has been the sort of bipartisan line, right? Is that, you know, our exports are sacred. And now they're green because natural gas is greener than coal, which, you know, has been pretty thoroughly debunked by a series of studies. But so long as we're, you know, sending our emissions out into the rest of the world, we don't really have a claim to be a climate, you know, a climate hero or a climate champion. And until that flow stops, it's really, really difficult to think about the US as sort of leading on climate, and not just, you know, not just the raw exports, but the amount of funding that we flow toward from like the US Export Import Bank, right? To do things like finance terminals in Mozambique for oil and gas, right? So these sorts of, there's a whole sort of apparatus of state support that goes toward the fossil fuel industry, both in the US and abroad, which, you know, has to be thought of as within our carbon footprint here and to be cut off.
If the sequencing is, you know, I mean, if there's some, you know, measures that can be taken from a governmental standpoint, what about from, like, you know, citizens, like from protests, like from movements? I mean, you know, last month we had two members, I think it was, of the Exxon board who were elected by essentially climate change activists. I mean, maybe that's a slight exaggeration as to who they were, but, you know, Engine One, which I guess is a, you know, a hedge fund that's the way they're marketing themselves. And to be fair, Exxon was bummed. What actions from a sequencing standpoint on the activist side do you perceive as being most effective in terms of, like, diminishing, you know, the biggest, forgive the analogy, the biggest bang for the buck in terms of diminishing the power of fossil fuel interests?
Yeah, as you said, most people probably don't have a couple million dollars to throw at an Exxon share, so we'll not suggest. Yeah. If you do, you know, I don't know, maybe that's a fine thing to do. I mean, I think honestly, just, you know, as it, in my job, have been tracking the infrastructure debates, it seems like nothing good is going to happen unless there are a massive number of people in the streets, and, you know, not just inchoately sort of going out and, you know, raising a sign on their block, but you know, joining things like the Sunrise Movement, getting involved with movements that are really trying to do this. And, you know, if you see a call from an organization which is working on the climate crisis, join it, you know, go get in the streets. Because I don't think, you know, I think we're reaching the point in the Biden administration, and arguably maybe reached that point a long time ago, where we've seen the extent of how far they're willing to go without a lot of pressure from outside, without a lot of pressure bearing down on them. That is how the New Deal happened. That is how we got some of the most transformative changes in this country. And there is nothing special about Joe Biden, which is he's going to, you know, enact ambitious climate policy of his own accord. People are going to have to fight for it, right? And I think that, you know, joining protests is a good, pretty easy first step if you're thinking about that. Doing a phone bank, right? You know, there are other sort of tiers of action, but I think getting involved with organizations who are working on this stuff is really, really key.
What should they be doing? I mean, what is it that they should be pressuring? Just, like, you know, like sort of political pressure for the Green New Deal, or you know, measures in the infrastructure, or are there, you know, specific things, I mean, that make it less profitable for these companies to do what they're doing? I mean, I'm, you know, from your, you know, aside from just, you know, going out and hitting the streets and marching, like what should they be marching for at that point?
Yeah, I mean, I think right now the sort of like micro fight is to get as much climate funding into an infrastructure bill as possible, pushing, you know, as folks marching in California and the Gulf have been doing, for a really ambitious civilian or climate conservation corps to be included in a reconciliation bill to make sure reconciliation bill happens. Obviously, I don't think a reconciliation is a word that belongs in sort of public facing messaging. It's a, these are sort of like wonky things to sell to people. But, you know, I think for the short term, that is kind of what the fight is, to, you know, fight for public renewables funding in an infrastructure bill, right? Beyond that, you know, I think a lot of stuff really does happen at the state and local level on climate, right? Utilities, for instance, have just totally overtaken state legislatures, and, you know, are pretty shocked when people show up to public service commission hearings to argue against power plants and, you know, new rate hikes and things like that. So there is a lot, I would say, that can happen on the state and local level if the federal level feels a little bit overwhelming.
Kate Aronoff, staff writer at The New Republic. The book is Overheated, How Capitalism Broke the Planet and How We Fight Back. Thanks so much for your time today. We'll put a link to that at majority.fm. Really appreciate you coming on.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, Kate.
All right. Going to take a quick break. Be right back. We are back. Folks, just have about a minute to go. But this, you know, short term agenda, if you're looking for one, it should be focused on calling your representatives, maybe going to protests or going to an event to encourage your Democratic representatives, Congress, Senate, to hold the line, pass the entire suite of infrastructure spending through reconciliation. And, you know,
particularly if you live in Arizona and West Virginia, in Virginia, where you got Mark Warner, Montana, John Tester, etc.
It doesn't hurt no matter where you are. But yes, those are the ones that are going
to
be
mobilize and be tactical.
There you go. Until tomorrow, we will say goodbye to those of you who are watching us on Peacock. We will see you then. And for those of you who are watching us everywhere else, poggers, hit the like and subscribe button.
Choo-choo, we're on the hype train.
Somebody put a graphic of me in a hot tub on Twitter the other day. Yesterday, I noticed.
We're like using your actual body?
Well, I mean, it
or
was
your head on two body.
Yeah, my head. There was no body.
I was wondering where they got that image from.
It's just they just took a screen grab, put me in a hot tub.
Hot tub time machine. I don't know. Yeah. Just ignore it.
Yeah. Folks, just a reminder, it is your support that makes the show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only support the free show, you get the free show free of commercials. And you help us chug along. This is, you know, this is We are in the more exclusive period of politics. This is when people who really care about creating something. You know, we had that metaphor, right, with climate policy, where there is the sort of disincentive, and we're going to tax, you know, petroleum products, fossil fuels, so that people are disinclined to use them. But of course, we've got to provide options for people, right? We've got to make things available. And that's, we're in that stage of creating something where we need to do that. And that is, frankly, that inspires people to follow politics less than the idea of, like, you know, Donald Trump is, you know, Donald Trump is, you know, a danger to all of us. And the Republican Party is a danger to all of us.
I mean, who knows if Manchin's messing with us? I just received, somebody just texted me this, actually.
Ryan Grimm, reporting in The Intercept, apparently audio obtained by Li Fong shows Joe Manchin suggesting donors talk to Roy Blunt, who's retiring, about his next life, hoping that will sway him to support the January 6th commission. I don't even
know. The one ahead of
right.
Sorry, no, this
yeah,
one.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Okay, leaked audio of Senator Joe Manchin call with billionaire donors.
He expresses openness to filibuster reform.
Yeah, and then I guess that's part of a larger story.
He got a lot of leaked audio of Manchin, basically.
It was a Zoom teleconference. That's the beauty about, like, you know, everybody's still on Zoom.
People can record.
Somebody can record.
Yeah.
It was a meeting hosted by No Labels, which is it's an organization founded in part by Joe Lieberman.
Blech. Perfect fit.
It funnels
peas in the pot.
Money to conservative and Democrats and moderate Republicans. And Manchin described an openness to filibuster reform in this thing, in this meeting. And he gives a list of who's there. Let's see. The wide-ranging conversation went into depth on the fate of the filibuster, infrastructure negotiations, and the failed effort to create a bipartisan commission to explore the January 6th storming of the Capitol. What's fascinating to me is that, like, this must really, like, I think, look, Joe Manchin is, you know, I think much of his reasoning is motivated, right? But I do think that he actually was, like, you know, even his most basic assumptions about, like, you know, bipartisanship were a little bit rocked when that January 6th thing, like,
he was like, they were coming after us.
And he says, he told the assembled donors that he needed help flipping a handful of Republicans from no to yes on the January 6th commission in order to strip the far left, it's you, of their best argument against the filibuster. So he is conscious mm-hmm. of, like, how ridiculous his argument about bipartisanship looks in the face of the refusal to pass anything on the January 6th commission. And he said the filibuster is a critical priority for the donors on the call as it bottles up progressive legislation that could hit their bottom lines. So this is Manchin saying to his benefactors, look, I'm getting squeezed here, and you need to make your money work in such a way that you're going to get Republicans, most likely the ones that are retiring,
right?
Because anybody who wants to get reelected wouldn't do it. You got to get them to vote for this thing that's clearly bipartisan. And when it came to Senator Roy Blunt, a moderate Missouri Republican who voted no on the commission, Manchin offered a creative solution. Roy Blunt is great. Just a good friend of mine. Great guy.
Great. Manchin said. Awesome.
Roy is retiring. Some of you all might be working with Roy in his next life. Could tell him that it'd be nice if he'd help our country. That would be very good to get him to change his vote. And we're going to have another vote on this thing. That'll give me one more shot at it. In other words,
yeah.
Can't somebody... Now, what is so unbelievable about that is... Imagine if this was not a vote that these billionaires didn't care about, right? Because these billionaires, they don't care about the January 6th commission.
No.
But imagine if it was just like something that was slightly, even marginally beneficial to them. Like, I don't know, tax break, estate tax, capital gains, some cutting of environmental regulations. You got Joe Manchin saying, hey, you guys are going to be, some of you are going to be hiring Roy Blunt through some entity that you funnel money into. How about you send him a little gift card or a thank you note, a pre-thank you note, and tell him vote this way and, you know, the pot will be a little sweetened. Can you imagine if it was something that these billionaires actually cared about? Like, Manchin is sitting here basically announcing this is the way it works.
Mm-hmm.
On this Zoom call, which is, you know, I don't know that people should be surprised by it, but I want to hear this audio because he's basically outlining how it works. And also, incidentally, if you want to know why he's not voting for S1, which pulls a lot of money out of politics.
Might have something to do with who he's meeting with.
There you go. It is, this
it's
is
really just, it's like, it's, it echoes mob boss backroom deals. It's just so, so sick.
It really is stunning. And, it's going to be really interesting to see what the fallout from this is because, I mean, presumably, right? Like, you got a bunch of billionaires on the Zoom call. I wonder who it was that leaked it.
Well, that's the point, right? Who, maybe it's some staffer or, well, why would a staffer be on it? I mean, you have to see when we check out this call, who was on the call, who would be incentivized to leak it.
It's, I wonder if.
The call included billionaire investors, Republican consultants. To me, it seems like this should all be buttoned up, given who's on the call.
Very interesting. Well, we will talk more about this as the days go on. In the meantime, we're going to head into the fun half. But first, Matt Leck of the Matt Leck Media Universe is going to tell you what's happening in that universe.
Yeah, we'll bring O'Brien Sutton's already in. Okay. Yeah. So for patrons on Monday, David Griscom and I talked to two history professors from Missouri State, Gene Bajelon and John Graham, about the 1776 Commission and how basically just anti-communism and pro-racism package for the new age. And also tomorrow. Lance from the Serfs is going to join us to talk about the Kamloops and other boarding school grave sites found, and also left the importance of indigenous struggles to the left in general. I'm getting a little bit of feedback, so I'm going to stop talking.
Oh, that's
very
weird.
Fun,
we're
yeah.
not hearing any
we're
feedback.
We're not hearing that.
Brandon, are you getting any feedback?
I'm getting feedback. Maybe it's on my end then.
That's
no,
weird.
it's apparently why? Everyone except us.
Everyone except us.
Wow.
How about now, Brandon?
No, I sound great. Do you hear me sounding as great as I hear myself?
Yeah, you sound great.
Thank you.
What's happening on the discourse these days?
Well, we just put out an episode for patrons about, you know, the lab leak theory, my theory on Dalmatian revenge. And
revenge. Of
course. Dalmatian revenge and the origins of Dalmatians as fire dogs, apparently.
All right, fair enough.
Is this inspired by that Cruella movie?
No, I actually just rewatched 101 Dalmatians, completely unrelated to the Cruella movie. Not, you know, unrelated in the sense that they're not about the same thing, just not because of that.
Yeah, I don't really. That's, I got no desire to see another Disney reboot. I wish it would just stop.
I'm done. I'm done with that.
I'm done. Yeah. So
let's head into the fun half, shall we? And Brandon will join us.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabs.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.